Part 25, Chapter 4. For days, Glencannon had brooded over this. His sleep was tortured with nightmares. In his mind, he could still hear the voice of his Swiss friend.
Go on! Go on! I will shoot them down! Keep going!
And then his scream when he was hit just before he ejected. And back of Glencannon's eyes, he could still see the view screen of his friend's body being shot to pieces in the air. He had his own playbacks of the war vessel that had launched those planes, and he had the shots taken of this monster overhead. It was the Terrify class, battle plane launching capital ship, Capture. There could be no doubt about it. That was the vessel that had butchered his friend. He felt he should have gone back, regardless of any orders. The two of them could have finished the Tolnep attack plane. He was certain. But instead, he had followed orders. He had suppressed the urge to go up and destroy that ship, and he felt that if he did not go ahead and do it now, his whole life would be a nightmare. He heard Stormlong's voice in clear cyclo on the local command channel.
Glencannon, you must come back! I order you to land!
Glencannon clicked the channel off. This was Stormlong's own Mark 32 he was flying. It had been in emergency reserve. It was rebuilt for high altitudes, the doors and ports sealed tight. It had huge firepower and even side bombs that could destroy half a city. It was armored to take a ferocious beating. And while its guns may or may not be able to penetrate the skin of a capital ship, there were other ways. They could not follow him from the ground. All other Mark 32s were at Lake Victoria, and here they were only using interceptors. No, they could not follow him. Not to the heights he was going. He vaulted skyward, higher and higher. He adjusted his air mask so it was snug. He was going to go out of the atmosphere. The Capture was swinging in a slow and ponderous ellipse, 350 miles above Kariba. It was 50 miles above the termination of the Earth's atmosphere. It was operating on reaction engines and was no longer simply sailing in orbit. Planes would leave it, streak downward to targets, and then return to be rearmed. One spotted him and dove. Almost with contempt, Glencannon centered him in his sights and pressed his fire button. The Mark 32 bucked in recoil. The Tolnep burst into fire and plummeted earthward like a comet. It alerted the Capture to his presence, and as he neared it, the gun ports winked and long laces of flame streaked the sky about him. One splashed on the side of the Mark 32. It made the flight deck hot. Glencannon danced back out of range. He saw the steering ports of the ship jet fire and anticipated its course. 25 miles in front of it, he began to tap his console to hold his position. It was just out of the Tolnep's range. He adjusted his view screens and began to watch. The stars were glaring bright in the blackness above him, but he had no eye for them. The earth spread out its curves below him, but he saw them not. His whole concentrated, obsessed attention was on the Capture, studying it. The ship resumed operation after a bit, believing his mission must be surveillance, not attack. The arrogance of such a ship was plain. It did not believe it could be hurt. It was once more launching and taking aboard planes. Glencannon saw that just before they opened the huge front ports of their hangar deck, a small exterior warning light winked, probably to warn approaching planes to stand clear and not get in front of the ship as it was about to open the door and launch. Each time the door opened, he studied the enlarged view screen of the interior. The entire hangar deck was cluttered with planes. Tolneps in pressure suits were racing about, fueling ships and loading bombs. They had gotten out much larger bombs now. They were leaving the interior magazine open. Fuel cans, probably liquid gases, littered the hangar deck. The Tolneps were overconfident and sloppy. But what could one expect of a slaver? Glencannon shifted his attention to the rearing, diamond-shaped bridge. There were two figures there, moving back and forth. One was not in uniform. A civilian, probably. The one in the naval cap seemed to have attention only for the civilian. No, they were not being alert. He turned his attention back to the outside light and the hangar door. He timed it. He calculated his own position. In the back of his mind, he could hear the voice of his friend from time to time.
Go on! Go on! I will shoot them down! Keep going!
That was exactly what Glencannon was going to do. Shoot them down! For the first time in quite a while, he felt calm, relaxed, confident, and totally determined. He was doing exactly what he had to do. The next time, the light went on. His hands hit the console. The Mark 32 streaked ahead, almost smashed him through the back of the seat with acceleration. Guns flamed in the capture. Balls of orange glare racketed against the Mark 32. It sliced straight through the barrage. Just as it entered the open hangar door, Glencannon's hand hit all guns and bombs. The explosion was a sun blowing apart. Johnny and Stormalong saw it as they stood outside the cone, back of a gun view screen. They saw the plane enter the hangar door with all guns blazing. But it required no view screen to see the flash. The abrupt glare lit the fading daylight for 50 miles around. It was painful to the eyes. It would be soundless in the void above the earth, but it was not motionless. The giant capital ship began to fall. A flaming arc began to draw its way down the sky, slowly, very slowly at first, but building up speed. And then it hit the atmosphere and began to burn more brightly. Down it came, further and further, lower and lower.
Oh my God,
said Stormalong.
It's going to hit the lake.
Down it came, faster and faster, like some huge comet painting the sky. It was dropping at an angle. Stormalong's muscles strained as though by will alone he could push it into the hills and away from the water above the dam. Down it came, a blazing incandescent wreck, traveling at great speed. 5 miles up lake from the dam, it struck. The heat and speed of passage thundered in the air. Then came the screeching crash of the strike. Steam and water geysered 1,000 feet in the air. There was an underwater flash as some remaining part of its fuel exploded. The shock concussion raced ahead of the wave, as great as any tidal wave. The deserted Chinese village was snuffed out as though it had never been. The concussion wave hit the back of the dam. The water wave inundated the structure, smashing flashboards, flying in a mighty cascade into the air at the dam front. The ground underfoot shook. Breathless, they steadied themselves and stared. Would the whole dam go? Waves subsided. The dam was still there, but there was new sound in it. The lights were still on, the generators were running. Guards who had been in the powerhouse came staggering out. Water was roaring down the river as the excess sped away, tearing down banks, ripping through islands. Engineers came racing from the cone. Most of the machinery which had been parked near the lake had been swept away. They were racing about trying to find a flying platform. They found one, embedded in the bank, half covered with mud. They freed it, swept the mud off it, and got it flying. The engineers and a machine operator went flying along the top of the dam. Johnny and Stormalong stood by beside a plane, waiting to see whether the engineers needed help. Their voices, in Chinese, were coming over a mine radio. The atmosphere armor over the cone was still sizzling in stage 3. Guards got back into the powerhouse and turned off the dam protection cable and reduced the cone armor to stage 1. Although this dam lake was 120 miles long, it seemed lower in level. Johnny and Stormalong were about to take off to see what the engineers had found when they came back. They landed and were reporting to Chong Wan. There was a lot of excited and upset talk, and Johnny went over.
They say the dam did not break,
Chong Wan told him.
Flashboards are broken all along the top, and even some concrete along the walkway, and the guardrails are gone. But that is nothing. They can see no cracks. However, at the far end of the dam abutment, over there on the other side of the dam, it seems to have shaken loose from the bank, and there is water escaping. They say water is erosive, and it could get bigger. It could even greatly lower the level of the lake to a point where the water turbines will not run.
How many hours?
Said Johnny. Chong Wan asked them. They could only guess. Maybe 4, maybe 5 hours. They would do all they could to stop the water and plug the leak. They did not have much grouting to seal it. The whole far end of the dam seemed to have torn out of the bank. They wanted to get back over and do what they could. Angus came running out of the passageway, seeking Johnny.
We can fire now! There is no shooting!
Maybe you can fire the rig,
said Stormalong, appalled at Glen Cannon's sacrifice.
But for how long?
At least he bought us that,
said Johnny, sadly.